is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking, to begin with, about generally education law, but we'll be very quickly going to current student issues and rights and special needs, children, and education services. My guest is Peter Sturges. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's practiced in the area of education law for 20 years. During that time, he's worked with school districts all over the state. He's dealt with a variety of student issues, including student discipline and expulsions, participation in athletic programs, test accommodations, computer use issues, and cyberbullying. Mr. Sturges also represents parents and students with special needs, including representing them with respect to Section 504 plans, individual education programs, and special education process. So we're going to be talking about that, a lot of issues, and those of you who listen to us live will be taking calls in the second half of the program. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the San Mateo County Bar Association, which is composed of 1,200 members. It's the only bar association in the country that provides private defender services for indigent criminal defendants. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California and the Family Law Section of the State Bar. And Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chuck. I wanted to start out the program by saying I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk about these issues with your listeners and hopefully inform them about certain things that I think all parents need to know.
There's so much to do here, so much to cover, that we have to limit it to something, and you and I have discussed what you think is the better thing to do. What are the current student issues that you want to start off on?
Well, I'd like to start off the conversation by dividing these sort of hot topics into two areas. One of the areas pertains to general education students, and then the other areas would be, for lack of a better term, special ed, special needs students. So with respect to the first area, some of the hot topics that I deal with these days are things such as student suspensions and expulsions, that sort of a thing. This is in the general education area. We have, unfortunately, situations involving harm to students that could cover a broad spectrum of areas, but this would be a negligent supervision. These cases come up, unfortunately, when you have allegations of abuse, that sort of thing.
When you say allegations of abuse, what do you mean by that? What's this? What's going on?
Well, to be candid, it's the cases that come up in the news where there are allegations of sexual abuse, student to student, or teacher to student, that kind of thing.
I see. Yes.
I've been involved in some of those cases. They're very unfortunate.
Yeah.
And one of the sadder aspects of my career over time is that I have come to realize that there is a fair amount of that going on, and I've lost any naivete I had in that area.
Mm.
Then I get issues concerning athletic eligibility. Students and parents want accommodation for taking tests if they're disabled, for example, the ACT or the PSAT, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of computer system use problems, and I
like what? What?
Well,
give us a couple of examples in that area.
Student,
you mean at school?
In the school environment.
In the school itself. Like what? What's going on?
It is an area that is very much in the news. You hear a lot of things like cyberbullying, which mm-hmm. is the harassment and bullying of students to other students. Through electronic media, for example, texting on the cell phone or emails, use of the school district's computer system, that kind of a thing, and the bullying of that nature can be very severe. And there were some cases in the news a while back, for example, some students, as a result of this type of bullying that they couldn't feel they could share with their parents, they committed suicide.
Oh.
And it was very bad.
Terrible.
They can be very serious issues. On a somewhat lighter note, there is the issue of sexting, which is...
What does that mean?
sending texts to others with sexually explicit materials.
This is on school computers?
Well, it could be through the email, but it's generally done on the cell phones.
On their own cell phones, okay.
And so the classic example is the boyfriend or the girlfriend thinks it would be a great idea to take a picture of themselves, either nude or partially clothed, and send it
to the other person.
On the cell phone. And then the couple splits up, and so in retaliation, they spread it out to the world. And the response from law enforcement has been sometimes quite bizarre, where they want to prosecute the students who did the dissemination under the notion of underage pornographic materials laws and that kind of thing. It really gets far afield from the real issue at hand, which is the bullying.
Yeah. Does the school have some jurisdiction over this kind of thing when the cyberbullying is on the student's own cell phone or whatever it may be?
They do. They do.
How does the school have jurisdiction of that?
Well, it is one of the many gray areas of the law, but they have the ability to enforce this to some extent, particularly on-campus conduct. So they would enforce it through, for example, codes of conduct. Students aren't allowed to use inappropriate language or sexually explicit materials. And a lot of people and young people think that simply because it's an electronic media that they don't have to follow the normal rules of conduct.
It's exempt.
But it's not true.
It's exempt from any coverage of the law whatsoever. Huh?
There's some sort of a mysterious insulation, right? It's sort of like the hacker mentality, I think. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. If the cyberbullying is not done on the campus grounds, and let's say it's from one student to another student, but not on the campus grounds, does the school have any jurisdiction over that whatsoever?
They can, but it becomes very attenuated. They have to be able to prove that the conduct in question actually disrupts school activities.
I see. Okay.
That's the standard.
What if a student is being the victim of cyberbullying, and let's say, so that it's straightforward, and this is on the campus? What can that young student do, if anything, to try to get some help from the school? Or have you found in your experience that most students who are victims of cyberbullying really are very reluctant to want to tell their teacher or tell the administration or whatever?
Well, unfortunately, most cyberbullying goes unreported, and schools are becoming much more enlightened to this, and they have, as part of their back-to-school process, they have an assembly, and they talk about issues such as cyberbullying and tell the students that they're inappropriate and tell them what to do if they experience it, and you can report it to administration for help. The problem is that a lot of the time the students are unfortunately humiliated by the process and don't want to report it, and that's where they're
humiliated. Why? Why are they humiliated? What happens?
Well, it's the same as if you are bullied and being made to be an outcast in a non-electronic format. Mm-hmm. They feel a very low self-esteem, and they buy into the notion that the criticism and the bullying has merit, and it really gets bad.
What a shame.
It is.
That's a real shame. By the way, one of the listeners of my program sent me an email, and we're going to talk about, of course, special needs kids. But there's an organization that actually Peter and I have talked about before we went on the air. I was not aware of this before. And I mention this now because it may be of some help to parents who have children who do need special needs. This organization is called Support for Families of Children with Disabilities. It's a nonprofit organization in San Francisco. It's a parent-run San Francisco-based nonprofit organization. It was founded in 1982, so it's essentially nearly 31 years old. It supports families of children with any kind of disability or special health care need as the children face challenges. And so the point that I'm making now, because of what actually Peter and I will be getting to in just a minute or two, is that should you be a parent of a child who has a disability and you need some help from an organization, although Support for Families of Children with Disabilities is a San Francisco organization and really is there to try to help people who are in San Francisco, it can refer you to other organizations throughout California should you, wherever you may be, because this program, Peter, is distributed throughout California. And, of course, we're on the Internet, www.kalw.org. And so let me give you the phone number in case you are one of those parents who may be trying to do something for your child who has a disability and you need some help from an organization that might be of some help to you. The Support for Families of Children with Disabilities number is 415-282-7494. That's 415-282-7494. And again, if you're not in the San Francisco area and you're anywhere in the state of California and you're looking for some help, you can call the Support for Families of Children with Disabilities and they will make a referral to you. Now, here's a question that came in from someone just thrown at me in the studio. What is the responsibility of school officials to actively intervene when they become aware of cyberbullying? In the past, there has been no obligation, and teachers have been reluctant to get involved. What comments do you have on that question?
Well, I'm fond of telling school personnel and students and parents when I give presentations on the issue that the way to analyze these situations, a good rule of thumb is if you sort of conceptually take away the electronic media involved and then look at the conduct outside of that context, and would it be objectionable or subject to student discipline aside from involving a cell phone or something like that? The other thing I would point out is that there is a much greater increased awareness about these issues, including the training of teachers and how these things come about, how to investigate these situations. And so I would say that while there may have been something of a reluctance in the past to do this, I think that the greater training now means that school administrators and teachers are much more willing to step in and do something about it if they know about it. So
But there is no, and correct me on this if you would, is there or is there not an obligation on the part of a teacher, if a teacher knows what's going on, to do something about it?
Yes, there is.
Oh, there is. Okay.
Yes, there
All
is.
Right. Well, then that answers the question. Things have improved considerably from what it was in the past.
Well, and that has to do with perceptions, too. There has always been in California what they call the in loco parentis rule, which means that teachers stand in the place of parents when they have the care of the students. And so they are supposed to guide themselves accordingly, and they have a duty to protect those students. So this is nothing new under the sun. Yeah. It's just been hidden behind this sort of technology shield, so to speak.
You know, this program is something where the audience of your legal rights obviously usually doesn't include students. People probably, certainly I would say it probably includes few people under age 25. I think when we start getting to people in middle age, it has a much bigger audience. I would hope that there are some students who are listening to this program and who might have a question for you or a dilemma that they are facing. And of course, kids are bashful. They're reluctant to do things if they are not the cyber bullier. The cyberbullier is not reluctant whatsoever.
That's true. It's kind of surprising the level of bullying that occurs, as I alluded to before, in a couple of situations the students have committed suicide over it. But I can tell you that these electronic media cyberbullying issues are very serious. I was involved in one case in San Mateo County where students broke into and corrupted data files and the district attorney elected to bring a number of felony counts against the student in question because of the conduct.
Really?
Yeah, it's a violation of the criminal code to corrupt and improperly access data.
Do you know what the result of the case was?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right. Let me let you know, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about current student issues and rights and special needs. We're just about to get to special needs children and special education services. My guest is Peter Sturgis. He's an attorney who has practiced in the area of education law for 20 years. He has law offices in Burlingame. And in a few minutes, I will give our local phone number. And for those of you who listen to the full hour program, whether it's locally or on the internet at www.kow.org, you'll be able to call in and ask a question. Peter, let's turn now, though, to the next section that you put in your outline for me to talk with you about, and that's the current special needs student issues. What essentially are those that you want to make sure we talk about, at least in the remaining minutes of the statewide version of the program?
Well, I would like to start out this part of our conversation by saying that parents of special needs students are caught in a perfect storm of competing interests in which they have to try to fend for their children and try to find out what the services they're entitled to may be. Mm-hmm. And even if their child has an issue or is a special needs student. So the areas I'm about to describe here touch on some of that process, and they've come up a lot for me in recent years. The first area is the failure to identify special needs students, and there is a law on the books, colloquially known as Child Find, where school districts and county agencies have a responsibility to go out and seek students with special needs, identify them, and provide them with the services. So they have an affirmative obligation to try to find these types of students, and there is frequently a failure to meet that obligation.
Is it because the volume of students in a class is so great that it's difficult for teachers generally to be able to focus on a child who may have a disability?
No, not necessarily. It has more to do, and this is in the early intervention preschool years, the mechanisms for identifying the students are imperfect at best.
I see.
So the agencies can provide the information, come find us. But I've had cases where the attorneys may take the position that somehow the school district is to try to find every student by knocking on every door, and that's obviously kind of impossible
of
to
course.
Do. Yeah, that
yeah.
kind of thing.
Of course.
Another area that is very active is the area of inadequate and incomplete assessments. If you think that your child may be a special needs student, you are entitled to ask the school district, or if the students are below age 3, mm-hmm. to conduct assessments to see if they may have special needs and qualify for services.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently the assessments are done in a slapdash fashion, and they're not thorough enough, and issues get missed.
How does a parent determine that? How does a parent determine that, hey, you've really dropped the ball here with my child?
Well, the parent usually have good instincts about what they're...
If your guts are telling you, hey, this doesn't seem right.
That's right.
Should you follow your guts? I use that as a kind of a rule of law for things. But is there any truth to that whatsoever?
They should mm-hmm. trust their instincts. A lot of the time, the public entity, will try to get away with simply doing a mere screening, for example, which is specifically prohibited by law. Screening is just a fairly cursory look at the student as opposed to a full-on assessment.
Who should do the assessment? Who's the person or persons who should do the assessment?
The law requires that the person who performs the assessment is somebody trained and qualified to administer the assessment in the area in question. So, for example, if you have a speech assessment, it should mm-hmm. be done by a speech and language pathologist, the SLP.
So it might not be someone who's actually full-time at a particular school, but someone who would be in the school district, I presume.
Yes, that's okay. a fair statement. So, interestingly, and to segue to what we just spoke about, organizations such as Support for Families with Disabilities mm-hmm. would be able to provide information about what assessments your child might need. That would be an excellent resource.
Really?
Sure.
Okay, okay.
Parents talk to parents, and they trade information about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of parents of special needs students of students who may have special needs don't really appreciate that there are several laws that protect their children. One is the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is just a general access statute, but it's the mm-hmm. same statute that prevails in the workplace for mm-hmm. disability claims.
Which we're going to do, by the way, next week.
There is a statute called Section 504 mm-hmm. of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which is the long version. And that leads you to a 504 plan, and then the main special education statute is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is the IDEA is the acronym.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, your student may not qualify for special education because there are certain thresholds that they must meet for the IDEA, but they are very likely to qualify for a Section 504 plan.
Mm-hmm.
And parents don't realize that. And a lot of school districts don't go to that second plan, although they should.
Without going into, because we don't have time for great detail, but a 50 plan really means what?
A 504 plan is...
Pardon me, 504 plan.
Yeah, Section 504 plan is an accommodation plan for these students' disabilities, both mental and physical.
For example, if a student is slower than, let's say, the average child in a class, and that indicates that the child may have some disability, that child may qualify for a 504 plan, for example, during testing time to have more time on the test. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And it's quite a complex area as to where the IDEA with the Individualized Education Plan, the IEP, and the boundary with the 504 plan lie. But parents should be aware that there is a spectrum of accommodations that can be made
mm-hmm.
that doesn't just stop at the initial mm-hmm. evaluation
mm-hmm.
process.
When you mentioned that the support for families of children with disabilities might be very helpful for a parent in trying to determine what kind of tests would be given and the adequacy of the test to the child, is it something that obviously this is a nonprofit organization, and I don't believe charges anything for the services that it does, as far as I know. Do you feel if a parent feels that he or she is treading water, you know, hopefully not going under, but just trying to tread water, that it's important to try to seek out an organization like this to try to get a little input in terms of what may I do to try to get the school to be more responsive to my child who it appears has a disability?
I do. And, in addition to that type of a resource, the California Office of Administrative Hearings,
mm-hmm.
known as OAH, the Special Education Division, has a list of low and no-cost attorneys and advocates who can provide services, and that's available online, and that's a good resource.
Give us that again, because I'm not familiar with that. The California Office of Administrative Hearings?
Yes, OAH. And if mm-hmm. you just put that in, it'll pop up their website, and then you go to the Special Education Division, and there's a link there to this list of attorneys and advocates. And
throughout the state?
Yes.
How wonderful.
And so they'll be able to advise you in that area as well. I think it bears mentioning that if you have an assessment process that you don't feel is adequate or sufficient, you are entitled to demand of the school district what they call an independent educational evaluation. In other words, we want another one done with an outside evaluator.
Mm-hmm.
And the district is required to do one of two things. It's required to either provide the parent that assessment at public expense, or it's required to file a request for due process. It's an administrative hearing saying that its assessment was legitimate. In many instances, the district will agree to provide the independent assessment.
Really? That's interesting. Are you concerned about the California budget, that this is going to be, this kind of service is going to be cut back?
Well, you've touched a nerve on that one.
I know that.
Well, these are tough times, although I did hear on the radio coming here that Governor Brown is cautiously optimistic about the current budget. I hope that's true.
I do, too. But there, I had not heard that, but I look forward to hearing it.
All of the mental health supports and various other public funding and education supports that we have are under attack because of the budget problems that we have. So there's always that issue. And then there has been a backlash over time, and it's nothing new, that too much money is spent on special needs students as opposed to the general education population, and the cost of the special education encroaches on the budget of the school district. It's called encroachment. So there is a kind of a backlash there, but there is a federal mandate that these things must be funded.
When in light of the fact that there's a federal mandate, are school districts throughout the state of California getting some federal money also?
There is some federal money, but it's insufficient, and unfortunately, the California state budget picks up the slack.
So let me go back for a moment. The independent educational evaluation that you referred to as far as the California Office of Administrative Hearings, if someone were to Google OAH or Office of Administrative Hearings and then look for a special education, they'd be able to find these low-cost or pro bono, both attorneys or, you said, what was the other category of person?
Educational advocates.
Educational advocate,
education advocates.
Which may not be an attorney, maybe someone else.
Yeah, and hopefully you have one that has some sort of training, but the law allows non-lawyers to represent parents and students in this area.
And very briefly, when you say represent, in what way?
They perform a function very similar to what an attorney would do. They can represent the parent at a hearing, but they usually accompany the parent to an IEP meeting and advise.
And that's the individual education program meeting, IEP.
Mm-hmm.
We have come to the end of the statewide version of the program. What I'm going to do right now, by the way, it's 7:20, it looks like 7:27 and a half, I think. At 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. For those of you listening to the program live, whether it's on 91.7 FM or www.klw.org, now is your time if you have a question. And I certainly would like to hear from students if you are out there and want to do something other than your homework. And have a good question or a concern, join us. The number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. If you have questions about education law, current student issues and rights, special needs children, special education services, whether you're a parent or a student, please join us. Don't be bashful. And for those of you who are wondering, when is the next Call a Lawyer Night? It will be in 2 weeks on January 23rd, that Wednesday evening, starting at 7 p.m., where you can talk to any one of usually either 7 or 8 attorneys separately, of course, off the air. No obligation whatsoever. It's a great community service that these attorneys perform, and that number you might want to jot down for Call a Lawyer is 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. My guest is Peter Sturges. For those of you who may have tuned in just a little bit late, has practiced in the area of education law for 20 years, and during that time he's worked with school districts all over the state, has dealt with a variety of student issues, including student discipline and expulsions, participation in athletic programs, test accommodations, computer use issues, and cyberbullying, just to mention a few things. His offices are in Burlingame, He spent many years as an attorney with school districts doing this same type of work in the education law area. And now, for how many years have you been doing this on the other side, that is, in your private office?
Oh, a couple of years.
Only a couple? Yeah, oh, yeah. So you're only recently out of the school.
That's
thing.
Right. My former colleagues accused me of having gone over to the other side.
Oh, no. You're wearing the black hat now, they're saying, huh? So in any event, if you have some questions, some comments, et cetera, don't hesitate to call in. By the way, in your list under current special needs students issues, one of the items is new therapies. What are you concerned about there, or what do you want to let us know about there?
Well, we get faced with the situation that parents of special needs students are often desperate to find some sort of a new therapy that will help their child either get quote-unquote cured mm-hmm. or improve their academic performance or something like that. And the law provides that a school district is only required to provide certain types of supports or therapies that are what they call research-based. So they have to have been tested. They have to have been based on data collected and that sort of a thing. And sometimes parents read about new therapies that they claim work for their students, but they're not accepted mm-hmm. as of yet mm-hmm. under the law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, they had a therapy a while back called auditory integration therapy, where they played various different sounds like music or something for the child, and that was supposed to improve their auditory processing. A little bit like Beethoven for babies. There used mm-hmm. to be a little mm-hmm. A tape thing for that kind of thing. That particular therapy was identified on a website, as I recall, quackwatch.com, as not being effective. But the parents in some, not all, auditory processing specialists were espousing, but mm-hmm. they couldn't obtain district support or payment for that kind of thing. That would be a good example.
So is that not available any longer because of that?
I think the parents still try it. It's just, and they can certainly try whatever they want, but it just depends on whether they can make a claim to the district for that.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, we've got Margaret. Welcome to your legal rights.
Oh, good evening.
Hi.
You know, I'm a grandparent, and I have a special place in my heart for children that in many ways and situations their self-esteem has been damaged somewhere along the way. And one thing that I am wondering in terms of the category of being disabled is if it's whether they aren't fluent in English. If they're Spanish and they don't want to speak English, but they do speak Spanish and they do write in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like to suggest to some teachers is that they would try to go across the aisle against all the odds with a hardly supportable optimism and speak in Spanish a little bit in the class and acknowledge the children's and the great writers in the Spanish heritage. They may not even be aware of these people, and let them see pictures and get some kind of synergy going, some kind of dynamic going, because I think these kids are just tested and tested and tested. And what I would like to see is them writing paragraphs in Spanish and then maybe translating them into English.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of an I'm okay, you're okay, let's work together. And I also would like to just mention that I think that our teachers need to have a real strong calling. They need to have a psychology degree. They need to be bilingual and maybe even some police training.
Except I'm not in favor of carrying guns in school.
No.
I know, Margaret. That's not what you're suggesting.
Like a probation or juvenile, like just firm, firm. I don't think they have to dress in a security guard uniform, but kind of, it's almost like they're in some kind of reform school because of their behavior.
Let me get some comments from Peter for you, Margaret.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. Some good comments. Thank you very much. The number, by the way, 1-415-841-4134 for your legal rights. What comments do you have in response to Margaret?
Well, Margaret has touched on a couple of very important issues. One is that there are students not just in the Hispanic, native Spanish-speaking community, but other ethnic communities that aren't native English speakers. And for language barrier reasons and cultural reasons, their students with special needs are under-identified generally, and that is something where there needs to be more work. The materials that are promulgated are put out in English and Spanish generally, but that's quite a problem. Another thing that I think that Margaret alluded to is that students who are special needs students are seen as behavioral problems as opposed to students who have a disability that may lead to behavioral issues. And there is a tendency of, let's just say, for lack of a better term, no-nonsense school administrators to treat these situations as, you know, the bad kid syndrome, as opposed to, do we have something more significant going on here that we should address at a deeper level?
Well, if a child doesn't have English as his or her first language, there's a problem where that child may not be understanding a significant percentage of what's going on in the classroom and feels just kind of out of it, I would think.
But I will say that the law specifically says that you do not qualify for special education supports simply because English is not your native language.
What do you do for those kids, though, who are not English speaking? How do you get them to do better in class?
Well, it's a real problem. If they do have special needs, the schools are required to inform the parents of their rights in Spanish, and they are also required to perform the assessments of the students in the student's native language.
So the special need, though, is not something where a child doesn't understand English but speaks in a different language and does not have, as you've talked about, a special need where perhaps the child is slow speaking or has some kind of perhaps psychological problem. You're not talking about as a special need just the fact that this child does not speak English.
That's correct. If if the only source of the difficulty is the language barrier, that doesn't qualify them, but it is one of the unfortunate aspects of the whole situation that you may not be able to see to the deeper need because of that language barrier.
Yes. What your thoughts with response to Margaret suggesting that perhaps teachers should have a psychology degree, should be bilingual? I mean, you've been an attorney for many, many school districts in this area of education law. What thoughts do you have about those comments of Margaret? A psychology degree and be bilingual.
Margaret may be interested to hear that California has quite a rigorous teacher credentialing process. And by that I mean that it requires teachers to get credentialed to have an additional year of a master's level program beyond their graduation, so that every teacher in California has basically the equivalent of a master's degree if that degree involves 1 year of postgraduate work. Part of the teacher training process does involve issues concerning the psychology of the students and that kind of thing, so that is embedded already. In addition, if the teacher has a special education credential, then they do have a great deal of training in that regard.
Do they? Okay.
So that is worked in there. I think what Margaret was getting at, though, is if we have these demanding situations, et cetera, that it's not just the ABCs that the teacher, the reading, writing, arithmetic, that they need to know about. It's my understanding that they do get training in that regard.
I see. Well, very good. All right, let me give you the number again. If you do have a question regarding special education, if you have a question regarding or a concern regarding special education services, or a general question about student issues and rights in the school, the number is 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841. Pardon me, 4134. My guest is Peter Sturgis, an attorney who has practiced in the area of education law for 20 years. His offices are in Burlingame. And before we take our next call, let me just mention this. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. Since this program is funded, this particular program is funded by the San Mateo County Bar Association. Of course, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. And if you'd like to talk to someone there during the normal business hour, the number is 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. Call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced in the area and set you up for a half an hour consultation with the attorney. Depending on what county you're in, it could be, for a half an hour consultation, a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. And it's a great way to get some basic information to determine what your rights and obligations may be. So I hope this is something you don't need, but it is available as a very important service. David, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just overheard part of the program, and as I was driving around delivering food, I'm from New Jersey, and I have an autistic younger brother. He's 24, going on 25. And eventually I see him living with me and me taking care of him. I was just a quick question wondering if you could tell me of any adult special needs education services that I may be entitled to with my younger brother, or that my brother might be entitled to.
Well, I'll have to admit that I'm not completely conversant with those types of services. California has a unique situation in terms of the mental health process. Way back in the, I think it was the late 60s, they enacted what is called the Lanterman Act, which was a very forward-looking act to provide for mental health services to California residents generally. And the state is divided into a number of what they call regional centers, and you may be able to go to your local regional center, which would here be the Golden Gate Regional Center, to see if you qualify for services for your special needs. Was it your brother or your...
Yes. Yes, my brother.
When you say the Golden Gate Regional Center, of what again?
The Golden Gate Regional Center is one of 11
That's
regional
centers. That's what it's
centers.
Called. That's yes. what it's called. Okay.
Yeah, it's literally right. the name of it. And they cover San Francisco County, Marin County, and San Mateo County, mm-hmm. I believe. Mm-hmm. That there mm-hmm. is an East Bay Regional Center, and there are regional centers that cover the whole state. So that's one area you could go to. And I believe if you call them, they could refer you elsewhere. Also, you can try to contact your county mental health department and see what types of supports they have. And you also might be able to receive some supports through Social Security, that type of thing.
Oh, yes. Back home, he's currently living with my dad. He is currently receiving both permanent Social Security and Medicare and now Medicaid.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Is he not, David, is he not able to work and have a job?
No, he's not nearly, I'd call him not nearly high functioning enough.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
One other thing I'm wondering, Peter, what about the Center for Independent Living? Do you know anything about that?
I'm familiar with the yeah. term, but it's not ringing a bell.
Okay, I think there is certainly in the Bay Area, there's a Center for Independent Living. You might want to Google that also, David.
Absolutely.
And find out. In addition, I would suggest, and I'm just throwing ideas out to you. In my job as a deputy DA for San Mateo County, from time to time, I deal with the Adult Protective Services Office of the county. Every county has an Adult Protective Services Office. It may be that you might want to put a call. What county are you in?
Oh, right now I'm in San Francisco.
Okay. You may want to call. You may want to call Adult Protective Services also. And, you know, I mean, you're doing some work here and trying to figure out what may work for you. You've got to do some homework, and I think that's one other area that you might want to contact.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck to you.
One more thing.
Well, don't go away, David. Stay.
It's my understanding mm-hmm. that when you attempt to obtain these services, that initially you may be rebuffed based on some sort of a bureaucratic standard or something like that, but I would recommend that you persevere and take it to the next level.
Good.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. That has helped us in New Jersey, too. That same condition applies. We were rebuffed, and then we kept pushing forward with the help of some very keen legal help.
We were
able to actually persevere.
Very good. Well, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my
Take
call.
Take care. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. All right.
Our number, 1-415-841-4134 for your legal rights. This is Chuck Finney, and my guest is Peter Sturges, an attorney who's practiced in the area of education law for 20 years and has lived to tell about it. Okay, who do we have here? We're going to have somebody else come on in just a minute. Let me remind you again that in 2 weeks we will do our Call a Lawyer night, and you'll have a chance to talk to one of hopefully at least seven, maybe eight attorneys that evening, one at a time, by the way. If you have some legal problem, and that number you might want to jot down, starting at 7 p.m. While I'm doing the regular program, you can talk with any one of the seven or eight attorneys off the air on our 800 number, 1-800-525-9917. All right, Julie, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I have a 15-year-old son who is a 10th grader, and last summer he was diagnosed with dyslexia, mm-hmm. dysgraphia, and other processing disorders. It greatly affects him in his writing, and the neuropsychologist that made the diagnosis suggested that he get either special ed services or a 504 plan for accommodations.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the school, the first day of school, and have had a couple of meetings, and this is the Oakland Unified School District, and the coordinator for the 504 plans for the whole district has, and the principal and everybody else who was at the meeting adamantly insisted that he does not qualify because his grades are not below average. So my son also, you know, in his testing, it turns out his IQ is in the top above 99 percentile.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's pretty unlikely he'll fail, although, you know, mm-hmm. without a lot of support, he doesn't do well. So he's been going to tutoring last year for his writing, and then now for his dyslexia, we pay for that privately, and we've tried to get extra. It was recommended extra time and being able to use a computer in class, but mainly extra time for tests.
And they won't go along with that
because he doesn't.
That's interesting.
His grades are below fail, or not below average.
Yeah.
And, you know,
They consider average a C, right?
Right. He has to have D's or below.
Oh, I see.
And his teachers have, you know, his CST scores, his state test scores are not, you know, he's proficient, although mm-hmm. his writing, he was, well, the English language arts, the last year he was 2 points into the proficient in all of the writing categories. He was below proficient, but they said that doesn't matter. He's proficient overall. And
so you've had no help whatsoever.
Right. Now, we've met with all of his teachers individually,
mm-hmm.
and most of them, except for the one who has dyslexia, oddly enough, are very happy to give him extra time.
You mean, wait a minute, one of his teachers also has dyslexia?
It turns out, yes. But
And will not give your son extra time?
He'll give him extra time, but he won't let him use...
A computer.
He insists that he writes his notes.
As opposed to using a computer.
Yeah. The teacher actually puts them all on the website so he could just print them out.
I see.
But he won't let him.
Very interesting. What comments do you have for Julie?
Well, Julie, based on what you're telling me, I think that the district is treading on very thin ice in the position that they're taking. It's a pretty common misconception that if the student is getting reasonable grades and that kind of a thing, that they can be regarded as not needing special education or 504 supports. But that's not the standard. The standard, broadly stated, is whether their disability
limits your
ability to access your education, right?
Yeah.
And so you can have a student with a high IQ that is being impacted by the dyslexic condition that could use some reasonable accommodations. And I'm not that surprised to hear about the district's response to the situation, but they lose sight of the forest for the trees because the accommodations that you probably are requesting, I would guess, are really rather moderate and not so
onerous.
Don't
even cost them anything.
I don't know why they dig in, but they dig in like that. So I think that you have a legitimate concern and a claim against them.
What do you suggest her next step will be? It seems like she's tried so hard.
I've called Washington, D.C., the Office of Education, Office of Civil Rights. They said I'm correct.
Mm-hmm.
But when I told, and they said, I should file a claim. When I told that to the school, they said, we work with them and we follow the law. They said, go ahead and file a claim then.
Mm-hmm. That would be a claim with the school district. Is that what they're suggesting?
Mm-hmm.
I see. Well, let me get some comments. What do you think she should do at this point, Peter?
Well, the mechanism that you would seek is filing a request for due process, which is the name for the administrative proceeding you're entitled to. And in that process, you would state your case and say what services and supports have been denied your child.
Mm-hmm.
But before you take that step, I would highly recommend the assistance of an advocate or an attorney to help you with that kind of a thing. But before you do that, you have to do your groundwork and set your case up a little bit. So I would go back to the person that assessed your child and found that they had dyslexia and get them to specifically identify how the dyslexic condition impacts their ability to access their education.
Mm-hmm. And put it in writing.
The neuropsychologist was at both of the meetings. I mean, he tried his best to convince them.
Do you have a written report from the psychologist?
Oh, yes, very
you do.
True.
Did the district
page report?
Did the district receive it?
Oh, yeah.
They're required by law to consider it. So has the district...
They don't deny it. They agree that he's got dyslexia. They don't.
Well, it's not
that
severe enough for them.
They just say it's not limiting him enough.
Yeah.
They say, our point is that, but with his IQ, he should be performing much better.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, we can't. The goal of public education is not for children to reach their full potential.
Unfortunately, that is a correct statement. The seminal Supreme Court case in the area provides that you only have to give the student a basic floor of opportunity, not to maximize their potential.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it does sound as though the district is unnecessarily digging in.
Mm-hmm.
I can say that if you file a request for due process, part and parcel of that process is a mediation.
Ah.
In which you have an administrative law judge come and mediate the dispute.
Really?
And 95% to 98%, a very high percent, of the cases that get filed with OAH settle through mediation. So it is one way of getting their attention, because they're going to stonewall as long as they think they can.
So in other words, in her filing a request for due process, is this something she serves upon the school district as well as filing it with the Office of Administrative Hearings?
Customarily, you would serve a copy on the school district, although the Office of Administrative Hearings, once it receives the request for due process, serves it on the other parties.
And where is the local Office for Administrative Hearings? Is there one up here in San Francisco?
There is an Office of Administrative Hearings in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
On Clay Street. I think it's 1212 Clay Street.
Have you tried that at all, Julie?
We haven't tried.
You have not. Well, give it a whirl.
The main office is in Sacramento.
Is it? But she would want to file her claim with the Oakland office, would she not?
Well, the actual filing procedures are quite informal, and you can file via fax.
Well, try that, will you, Julie?
Okay.
Yeah. Good luck to you.
I mean, the reason we're pushing so hard is we're trying to get him accommodations for the SAT, and you can't get it unless you've had a formal plan in school.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a pretty common issue, and under the three laws I talked about, the ADEA and the 504 and the IDEA, all of them would provide for some sort of an accommodation in that regard. So, you know, you don't have to qualify for special education to get some of the relief you're seeking.
Well, good luck to you, Julie. We've got to move on.
Okay,
thank you very much for calling, and I wish you the best of luck. Here's a question that came flying into the studio here. Art school district caught between a rock and a hard place? Many schools are faced with budget deficits and teacher layoffs these days, but accommodating special needs students can be extremely expensive and can exacerbate schools' financial challenges. Understandably, school administrators want to keep costs down. How do you respond to that question?
Schools are frequently accused of being resistant to providing special education supports and services because of cost factors.
Yes.
They are specifically prohibited by law from doing that. Cost can be a factor, but they can't deny you the service you're entitled to solely based on costs. That being said, you have hit the nail on the head. There is an enormous tension between providing these extra services, who's going to pay for them, and how does it impact the general student population? And there's no easy answer.
No.
There is a lack of funding on the federal level and at the state level. And I do believe that if there was more funding for these types of services, that the school districts wouldn't be resistant to providing them.
Keep trying, Julie. Don't give up. I want to thank you very much, Peter, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure having you on the program. My guest has been Peter Sturges, an attorney who has practiced in the area of education law for 20 years. His offices are in Burlingame. Thanks so much. By the way, I just want to remind you that in 2 weeks, on January 23rd, we will have our Call a Lawyer night starting at 7 p.m. You might want to jot down the number. As I'm doing the regular program, you can talk with one of several attorneys off the air. It's a great consumer service, 1-800-525-9917. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr. Nice to have you back, Joanne. Production assistant is Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the San Mateo County Bar Association, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the Trusts and Estates section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, and the California Applicants Attorneys Association. Next week, if you are having a difficulty at work because you have some kind of disability, we're going to be talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act in the workplace. My guests will be employment law attorneys Lisa Lawson and Phil Horowitz. That's next week on Your Legal Rights. Thank you very much for joining me. I'm Chuck Finney.